Well, good morning. It's good to be here this morning. I brought some liquid up with me because I'll probably need it. I got a little bit of a cold this morning, so I told Richard I probably won't be able to talk for 45 minutes, so y'all are in luck today. Anyway, I'm going to go back to 1 Corinthians. I kind of struggle with knowing where to go. Next Sunday's ordination. This is our last Sunday before then, and nothing else really seemed to make much sense to me, so I felt I was supposed to go back to 1 Corinthians. So we're in chapter 10. I'm going to do the first half of the chapter. There's a fairly distinct break in the middle of the chapter as far as, you know, subject is talking about. It's verses 1 through 22, and then we'll do, the next time we'll do the rest of the chapter. So I'm not even going to read the rest of it this morning, so we'll do 1 to 22. All right, so 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, 'The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play.' We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents. Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? What do I imply then, that food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he?" All right. So going back now and starting kind of at the beginning and working our way through, this was one of those passages that was a little confusing to me for a while, and then it seemed like all of a sudden it was just boom, there was a little bit of a veil lifted from my eyes, and I kind of understood a little bit better what it was saying. So I think what Paul is doing is he's setting up his readers for what he has to say in the following. So that whole first section where he's talking about, he says, "I don't want you to be unaware, brother." So there's something else he's going to say coming, ahead, and he doesn't want them to be unaware of the context when he says this. And so then he goes into talking about the Israelites, their fathers. And now I'll stop right there and back up a little bit. Remember that the Corinthian church is not nearly all made up of Jewish people. It is kind of a conglomeration of all different types of people. There's Jewish background people, there's pagans, and that would include Greek thinking people and just a conglomeration of different religious backgrounds. Plenty. I'm sure there was those in the church here that would have come from a pagan polytheistic background where there was many gods that they worshipped. And so I'm not sure if he's just dives into this specifically aimed for his Jewish readers. I know, when he says what he does toward the end of there, he mentions pagans. And so I think maybe the pagans understood this even quicker than the Jewish people in his audience did, which is why he kind of dwells on their angle of it by going back and talking about their fathers, the Israelites. So he says, talking about their fathers, says, "All were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." Now this is I think a type and shadow of what the church is. So we know in other places in the New Testament, there's places where baptism or going through the Red Sea is a foreshadowing of what baptism will be. There's a whole system of types and shadows that I probably won't go very deep into that, but it is really interesting about the whole, Israel being delivered from Egypt, wandering, goes through the Red Sea, wandering around for 40 years because of disobedience and all that. There's a lot of parallels to the Christian walk where, we get saved, we come out of Egypt, we're baptized, and anyway, there's a whole bunch of stuff with that, and it's really fascinating and interesting. And there are various places in the New Testament where it's directly alluded to as such. And I think that is simply what he is doing here. He is saying that they were baptized into Moses through the cloud and in the sea, just like you were baptized into Christ. Because a little bit later, right down here, he says, "All ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink. They drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." So that whole section there where he's talking about the Jewish people, I think he's simply saying, these people, I mean, they had, if you want to talk about pedigree, the Jewish people probably had a pretty high view, at least some of them from the start, had a pretty high view of their pedigree, I can almost sense in this passage that he's kind of maybe poking at the pride of his Jewish readers a little bit and trying to bring out this whole thing. Okay, so your fathers, Moses, they knew Moses firsthand. They were in that first generation. They saw all these things. They passed through the sea. They saw the cloud, all these things. And it says they drank the same spiritual drink. They drank from the spiritual rock that followed them. The rock was Christ. And then in verse 5, it says, "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." And then he says, now these things took place as examples for us. So let me see if I can communicate what I'm trying to say. Let's bring it to our day now. We have a little bit of a pedigree too. A lot of us we grew up Anabaptist peoples, and there was a lot of people in our heritage that died for their faith. I mean, it was worth everything to them. However, that does not mean that we somehow have some, we're not better than anyone else. Yes, there are blessings passed down, and that's very biblical. There are blessings that come from being obedient to God, but it does not change the fact that we as individual people still have to make that choice. And he's reminding them in verse 5 when he says, nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, he's saying, even though those people, they were with Moses, they saw all these things, even those people screwed up and turned their backs on God. And I think the reason he's saying this is because he's preparing them for what he's going to talk about next, which is idolatry. They fell into idolatry. And I think it seems to me that the church here possibly was maybe a little bit proud of the fact, they were maybe a little proud and thought they weren't susceptible to doing that kind of stuff and falling into idolatry. And I think that's where it can really easily come to us today. I think we can be in that same place. Like, I know I can. You know, we can kind of have this idea, you know, I've you know, number one, I got a good heritage. Number two, I grew up in a good family. I've been here, I've heard this stuff my whole life, and like, of course I'm not susceptible to some of that stuff that those people are susceptible to, right? I think that attitude is what he is putting his finger on here. And so he's reminding them, even though those people, ancient Israel, even though they saw, even though they were right there, they were basically, you know, the law and that whole thing, the baptism into Moses, all that was a foreshadowing of what will come then in Christ. And it was a teaching. I'm actually reading through Exodus right now. It was kind of interesting, you know, because I actually read through pretty large sections just in preparation for this, because it ties together. You know, he talks about them, and so I went back and I read about some of those things, and it's literally, if you look at the overall picture, it almost looks like he's taking a two-year-old, that would be the Israelites coming out of Egypt, taking a two-year-old, and starting a complete reprogramming. I guess we're not necessarily reprogramming a two-year-old. Well, sort of, because they are fallen. But basically starting from the ground up and line upon line, you know, and some of these things, you parents will understand this. There are times when you ask your young child to do something or not to do something that's not even a right or wrong thing. It's just simply you're telling them this in order to teach them something, or in order just to teach them that, you know what, sometimes you're the authority, and you, not sometimes, you are the authority, but you are the authority, and they need to listen to you and obey, obey you, even if they don't understand. Like, we do that a lot as parents. And I honestly think some of the law is that. Like, if you go back and you read all the nitty-gritty details, like, it's kind of crazy sometimes, some of the stuff. And I honestly think sometimes it wasn't necessarily because some things were like a right or wrong issue. It was just God saying, I have to teach this people to trust me and do what I say even when they don't understand. And so it literally was that. It was building them from the ground up. And it was also interesting. He did not, the times that are mentioned here where there was like serious repercussions for them either grumbling or, you know, doing various things, whatever it was, all of those repercussions actually came after he had given the law. So, you know, the first part there, not exactly how long it was. It was a couple months, I think, before they got to Sinai. And they grumbled and complained pretty hardcore even in that first time. But at that point, God was still somewhat in the overlooking stage. You know, later, I think it's in the New Testament, there's a verse that says that sometimes, at some points in time, God overlooked certain things. But now, he's not. And anyway, that's not really exactly to do with everything, but it's just interesting how that progression was, that God was very merciful with them until after he gave the law and they directly disobeyed him. Like, the Ten Commandments are given in Exodus 20, and it was like not very long. I mean, literally the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Number two, thou shalt not make any graven image. And it wasn't but a couple days or a week or two later when Moses goes up on the mountain again and he's gone for 40 days and 40 nights. And they're like, where did this guy go? He's gone. And they're like, hey, let's make, you know, they ask Aaron, make us gods. And so it's really odd. I'm not quite sure how Aaron got off the hook like he did in that whole thing. But anyway, so he made him a golden calf. And it was just like so blatant. And I know there was swift judgment then directly after that. And I know as a parent, I can relate to that too. You know, if sometimes they don't understand something quite right or whatever, there's a little bit of time. Maybe they forgot or something. There's a little bit more grace there sometimes. But when you tell them something, straight up, this actually happened this morning. When you tell them something straight up and they leave from that, you telling them, and go straight and do exactly what you told them not to do, there's repercussions for that. And that's exactly what they did. Like with the golden calf incident, it was like so close. And God was, it says after that, God was so angry. He wanted to just wipe this people completely out and start completely over with Moses and his lineage. And Moses said, yeah, anyway, I don't understand how that works. You know, Moses basically, you know, I don't know if he talked God into backing off or whatever. That gets into whole other things, but it's an interesting thing. But he relented from doing that. However, he did judge them. So anyway, that's kind of background stuff for this. But going back up to where we are now, so he's reminding them of these things that happened. And he says in verse 6, these things took place as examples for us that we might not desire evil as they did. And this is, you know, it almost sounds unfair, but it is very merciful of God to do this. We're allowed to learn from the mistakes of other people, and then we don't suffer the consequences of doing those things like the other people that did those. You know, it seems to me like it, you know, everybody, it's kind of unfair, but it's a grace and a mercy that God gives to us, where he gives us stories like this. And he judged people harshly. Nabat and Abihu, you know, they came and they offered strange fire, and bam, the fire of God consumed them, or it killed them. It didn't consume them completely, because it says they drug them out by their clothes, basically, outside the camp. And they were just, like, horrified. And moving forward to the New Testament, you know, this is not, God didn't just do that then. Because in the early church, we learned, well, in Sunday school here a couple months ago, we went through the story of Ananias and Sapphira. And I think that was another thing that was the same deal. There are times when God does, like, it seems like extreme, immediate consequences on people. And that is for our benefit. It is the mercy and grace of God in doing these things that allows other people to see, hey, God's actually kind of serious when he says some things. You know, he is merciful, he is long-suffering. He is long-suffering way beyond probably anything that you or I can ever muster up. You know, there comes a time when we just want to bring the hammer down on somebody that continually and on either, you know, does something directly to us or just, you know what I'm talking about. God is very long-suffering. But there are times when he judged quickly and swiftly because he wanted to teach us a lesson that I am serious when I say what I say. So moving on a little bit. Let me see here. So that, basically that first section talks about Israelites. He's, like I said, we kind of went through all that. In 13, or in 12 then, I think it kind of gets to the gist of what he's trying to say in this passage. Verse 12 says, "Therefore, or because of this, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." That to me right there says there was some pride. There was an issue of pride in the church of where they were and where they thought they could never go. And he says, oh, no. Even these people, with the pedigree they had, they did this. And if any of you think you stand, take heed lest you fall. And then he goes into what he's going to say. So I think up to this point, he's still setting them up for the message he wants to give them. 13 says, "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape that you may be able to endure it." So 13 again, that is another leveling of the playing field. There is no temptation taking you except that which is common to man. And this kind of hit me a little bit. I had to do some repenting because it's so easy for me to think, you know, especially with all the stuff we see going on in the world today, we see people doing stupid things and, you know, partaking in things that are just like, come on, do you not get it? And do you not understand this is, you know, going against what God wants? But this brings it all back to a level playing field. There's no temptation taken you except that which is common to man. Everyone here has the ability to be tempted with anything. That doesn't mean we all have the same susceptibilities. Like there is definitely, as you grow in your faith and as you grow and mature, you are strengthened in certain areas when it comes to temptation. Doesn't mean that everyone is equally strong in every area, but it means that we are people. And everyone that came before us, they were people. The Israelites were people. I have, in the past especially, you know, when I was my late teens, early 20s, I could be really, really hard on the children of Israel when you go back and you read about some of this stuff. Like, seriously, a week after God said, don't do this, they just did it. And it's easy to be hard on them, but I find myself like I can really, really easily do that too. Like, it's not that hard to do that because they're people. We are people. And I think especially in today's culture, this whole thing going on where, like, there's no grace at all. Yes, there needs to be justice sometimes. Thankfully, God's in charge of justice. I'm very happy because he's perfect. He can dole it out perfectly. But what's so easy to forget and what our culture and the world has forgotten is that there's people. And when we have people, we have issues. Everyone has issues. And we all ultimately, in the grand scope of life, we all deal with the same slate of temptations. There's different outcomes because there's different responses. But because it says here, then God has provided a way of escape. There's nothing that you can be tempted with that God has not provided a way to escape that. And I think, you know, a little bit later here, well, actually, verse 14, it says, "Therefore," which this is another therefore. You've probably heard it many times, but I was taught when there's a therefore, you got to find out what it's there for. So it basically ties it back to what was before. So because of the fact that, don't be proud, don't think you've got it all together, because it's when we're in that situation, it's easy to fall. Everyone is ultimately tempted with the same things on a grand scope, and God has provided a way. So because of that, now he's going to get into idolatry, and I think this is what he wanted to get at from the very beginning. "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." And when I read that verse, the first thing I thought of was Joseph. You know, it wasn't exactly idolatry, but he did the same thing. He fled. There was temptation, and he fled from it. And I think that gives a pretty good way of escape. I think this way of escape that, you know, God has made, I don't think that means that when a temptation happens, you can just stand right there and clench your fists and stand right in the middle of it, and it'll eventually pass. There might be a time or two when that works, but there are other times when fleeing is what's supposed to be. Stay far away from these things. Joseph ran away, and he says here, flee from idolatry. So then let's get into idolatry a little bit. Now he's going to, from verse 15 to verse 18, he's going to bring in some situations to kind of help him explain what he's talking about. And he starts off saying something nice about them. I speak as to sensible people. So he's like, I think you guys you can think through this. You're sensible people, so think about this. Think about what I'm about to tell you. He says, judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? That's the communion, the Eucharist, that whole thing that we do, that Christ implemented. That is a participation in the body and blood of Christ. So, you know, there's something that happens in the spiritual realm that I don't understand, and I think a lot of us don't understand. We've talked about it. I've heard it many times. There's just something that happens that we don't quite get. But there is something. Somehow, some way, when we partake in the bread and the wine, there's a participation, there's a fellowship, there's a worship, somehow you are communing spiritually. Remember that word spiritually has kind of a connotation of like, at least in my mind, spiritually kind of has this connotation of kind of high and mighty kind of stuff. All it means is it has to do with spirit. So we as human beings are, you know, we have bodies, that's what we see, and we have soul and we have spirit. And this is dealing with the spirit part of us. So somehow in the spiritual realm, there is a participation and a communion that happens during communion, what we call communion, the Lord's Supper. And then he goes back and gives another situation. Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? So that was another one. So when they would sacrifice these sacrifices on the altar, they didn't always just burn the whole animal. There was often certain parts that were burned and offered as sacrifices, and then the rest of it was a barbecue, basically, and they ate it. This is how, you know, the Levites especially, that's how they lived and survived. The offerings, they ate them. But there were also other people that would have eaten the leftovers that were not sacrificed and actually burned on the altar. And so he's saying even those people are participating, they're participants in the altar. So he's trying to convince them that there is a connection here. There's something that happens in the spirit realm when you do these things, when it's, you know, either communion or whether it was in the old days, the altar. So then in verse 19, he says, what do I imply then, that food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? Now, some of you are probably hear that and you're just like, oh yeah, I know exactly what makes perfect sense. Well, for me, the word anything kind of threw me for a loop. And the best that I can put it into language that made more sense to me is that it exchanged the word anything for nothing. And it made more sense. What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is nothing? Or that an idol is nothing? And then right after that, verse 20 says, no, that's not what I'm saying. Then he says, this is, think this is the message he was driving at from all the way at the beginning. So he was setting them up all the way through this until he gets to this. So he says, no, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be a participant with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? So there was idolatry was a big, big thing in the city of Corinth. In, you know, all around this church, idolatry. And it was like in your face kind of idolatry, where, you know, if best I can describe it is if, you know, if we go over to Asia, I'm sure Austin will. Some of you have been to Asia, but Austin was there for a long time. And over there, there's this thing of idols all over the place. Like, Eastern religion still has many actual idols, whether they be out of stone or wood or gold or silver or anything. But, you know, here in our culture, it's not nearly as common to have an actual idol that, you know, people come and worship. It's a little more subtle than that. But, you know, in the Eastern religions, it's just out there. And what Paul is saying, he says, I'm saying that what pagans sacrifice, they're offering to demons and not to God. So there's, I have thought growing up, and I'm sure some of you have thought the same thing. How can you just like walk up to a thing made of stone and like bow down and worship that thing? Like, because it's just a hunk of rock, isn't it? But what he's saying here is that it's not just nothing. This whole thing of worshiping idols, even, you know, back where the Israelites worshiped the golden calf, it wasn't just, this idol is not nothing. He's saying there's a spirit entity behind that idol. Or there's a spiritual entity that is that this idol represents, basically. And he's saying, that's what I'm implying, that the pagans are sacrificing, they sacrifice, they offer them to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to be a participant with demons. Now, let's go back to the very first of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. That's a little letter G, gods. See, in ancient religions and Eastern religions, not so much in the Western culture, but in a lot of, I would say probably in the majority of humankind, in the history of humankind, in the majority of cultures, there was actual worship of gods or some kind of spirit entities. And, you know, human beings, we're made to worship. We're going to worship something. It's just ingrained in our DNA. We want to worship something. And God says, no other gods before me. That before means in front of, basically. And I don't think, you know, obviously we wouldn't say that, well, you can have other gods as long as you put them after the true God. I don't think that's correct either. But that's a distinction to make. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And think about when that was given to the children of Israel, how much of a kind of a shock that was, because, yes, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, he came to Abraham, which Abraham probably was in a polytheistic culture of some sort, many gods. And then it was only a couple hundred years later when this was actually given, and these children of Israel had just come out of a couple hundred years of living in Egypt. And if you've studied anything about old Egyptian culture, I mean, it's like, there's all kinds of stuff. There's the cat god, and there's the sun and the moon and the everything god kind of thing. And he's telling them, no, there's me. And he says, I'm a jealous God. This is the connection at the end here. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy by worshiping other gods? No, absolutely not. Verse 21, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. So how does this, what does this mean? What does this mean for us? We don't really have to, in our daily lives, walk around and choose whether or not you're going to bow down to a stone idol or a whatever. What are the idols, and I'm sure you've heard sermons on this, what are the idols in our culture? There are plenty of them. but what I want to bring out today and what I think Paul is saying here is, remember, these things are not nothing. And I'm also not saying that absolutely everything has a demon behind it. That's not. But this is what it says. He says here, the idols of the pagans are a physical representation of a demon behind it. At some point, I'm not going to do it this morning, but I think maybe before I go into the second part of 23, we'll maybe do a sermon on what are they and who are they and what do they do, and I'd like to learn more about these things. But anyway, I can't really argue with that. It's what Paul's saying. He says that's what's behind these things. And I think it's just as equally true for us to say today, whatever is an idol, even if it doesn't have this stone image today, what is an idol in our culture? And these things are backed by spiritual entities. And we can't worship both. God does not take kindly to that. He is a jealous God. He requires worship of Him alone. And I honestly think sometimes in our culture it's even harder than in the cultures where the idol is made out of wood and stone and gold and silver and it's sitting there. We have to, like Paul said, I speak to you as a sensible people. You guys are a sensible people, and we have the ability to think. And I'm challenging me, and I'm challenging us as we navigate what are the idols in our culture, and how do I stay away from them? How do I give my worship to God alone and not, you know, participate in the table of demons? That's a hard question. That's why it takes a sensible people, and it takes critical thinking and a critical mind and a thirst for the truth to come up with the right answers to these things in our culture. So let's bow our heads to pray. Father in heaven, thank you so much, first of all, that you are merciful enough to have given us stories and examples of, you know, people in the past that maybe you dealt really harshly with, but you're using that as examples to teach us things of what you desire for our lives. And it's not a thing of you've got to do this, but you ultimately have our best in mind. You know what is best for us. Like Joe talked about last week, you know what we need to do so that it is well with us. And so, Lord, we ask for wisdom and discernment as we navigate our culture and our world around us. May we be able to see where there's an idol, and to speak, number one, to flee that idol, but also to speak truthfully and honestly about what it is. And we also are very grateful that you have given us everything we need to fight this battle in the spiritual realm, whether it's, you know, the sword of the Spirit, the whole armor of God. You've given us everything we need. And so I just ask for that wisdom, discernment, and a thirst for the truth from all of us here, that together we can give our honor and allegiance and worship only to you. And in so doing, we can be a message to the rest of culture. Thank you. In your name I pray. Amen.